I picked up that scanner, got it unpacked.
I'm glad you finally got it. Have you used it yet?
I have had been very limited on time this week, and so I've had a little bit of time to start working with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've scanned like 40 pictures, which is really just the same picture that many times.
Yeah, one picture 40
times. I
just keep
scanning the same negatives over and over and over.
Well, if you scan it, maybe eventually you'll get a good result.
I didn't realize how hard scanning was.
Well, what's hard about it?
I'm just saying, on the face of it, I feel like you just put the negatives on the thing and you hit scan.
Yeah.
Done.
It sounds easy.
Yeah. What else are you going to do? Come on. Like, you just scan it. It's not that easy. It's like I had to download the Epson software, and it has its own these little negative trays that you can put. It's six. If you cut your negatives into six photos, six 35mm photos long, you can hold two of them. So you can scan 12 photos at a time. But whenever you bring this in, it's like, do you want to scan them as color positive or color negative? And then you can pick the DPI, and you can pick up to like 12,000 something DPI.
Jeez.
But if you pick like the highest DPI, it's like, all right, it's going to be 30 minutes.
Yeah, I bet it's very slow.
So slow. If you scan it like 2400, 3200 to do 12 images, it's like 10 minutes.
That's not as bad. That's longer than I would have expected, I think.
Yeah, it's like let it go and then like come back later kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I can like hear it. And so whenever it stops, I go, oh, okay, mm-hmm. I can go look at my pictures. Eh? I've been watching Fargo.
What do you think it's doing for 10 minutes? Does it sound like it's making multiple passes? Like why does higher DPI take longer, you think?
I don't know.
I mean, this is basically a camera. A scanner is basically a camera. I'm curious what it's doing.
What it's giving me at the end of the day is, well, I mean, it's not basically a camera. It's doing, like, yes, it's shining light through the thing, but the way that a scanner, like, shines and captures light is much different than, like, a CMOS sensor.
Okay. Didn't realize that.
Not the same. I can't go any deeper than that. I've read about it once, and I go, I really don't care about this. I mean, like, I care. Anyways, just totally different tech.
Okay.
I'm sure that I'm totally wrong, and someone's going to write in. That's fine. We'll read that email. We will read the email when it comes in.
If they write in, then that just saves us from doing the research.
Yes. Anyways, when you scan it, you say, scan the things, it gives you pictures. Like, it literally, like, here are 12 JPEGs.
Oh, so it automatically splits them out in individual photos.
Yeah, automatically crops it and all this stuff.
Oh,
except it keeps not getting it exactly right. And I'm like, I scoot it up a little bit? Like, why? Like, I don't know if it's the Phoenix film because it's purple and it just can't figure out the contrast. Like, maybe those darker edges are harder to auto detect. I don't know what it's doing, but I don't know where the option is to, like, just scan the whole stupid thing and let me crop it out.
Yeah.
Where's that choice? Huh. I don't know. And so it gives me all the images, and I'm like, great. They're not all fully aligned. Or this one looks weirdly soft because, like, getting the height of the thing just right so that it doesn't I don't know. It's just, it's weird, like, finding the right DPI. And I've had some where I scanned it in one DPI and, like, the noise is extremely prevalent. And I scan the same picture at a different DPI with, like, the high versus low resolution, like, image quality setting. And then the noise is, like, less apparent. So that's been a whole thing. And then also, particularly because this Phoenix stuff is purple.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, maybe I should just scan the normal negatives of the Kodak Ultra 400.
Yeah, I was wondering if that would work better.
Maybe I should just do that first before I finish dialing in the Phoenix stuff. But if I scan it as color positive, the images come back very orange, extremely orange. But if I scan it as color negative and then I invert it myself, they're perfect. They're not too orange. They're exactly white balance to daylight as they should be because it's a daylight film. And so I'm like, I have to scan it as color positive, even though it's color negative. So then I could convert them to color positive myself, either using like Film Bro? I can't remember the name of that app that I've been using. Film Lab. Or I can like do it in Lightroom and whatever. And I've actually found that like the Lightroom one maybe looks the best, weirdly enough, even though for some other stuff that I've scanned, the Film Lab looks better. It's just been a whole thing.
This is a lot more complicated than I thought.
There's so many levers. It's like, do I scan it as color positive or color negative? Do I do the conversion myself? Do I let them do it? How do I get it aligned? What resolution do I set it at? And then like every iteration that I test this, I have to like wait for like 10 minutes or whatever. And there was one point where I like had 12 pictures in there, but it was only scanning the first one. So I had to like take the stuff out and put it back in. And then it did scan. it's just so much. There's too many levers and there's not enough levers.
Yeah, that's weird.
I think some people use SilverFast or something. Silver.
Is that an application or what?
Yeah, it's a different, it's like a scanning app for scanning film. And I think they'll use that with the scanner rather than using the built-in scanner software, because you can like preview the image, pick where it crops all the images, and then tell it to do the scan. So maybe I need to like look at that instead. I don't know, Daniel. The scanning thing is like developing it myself. I said, this is totally worth the money I'm saving. And then scanning will just be a breeze. And now that I'm scanning it, I'm like, you know, that $10 that I was paying to make other people scan these images, I get it.
Welcome back to the Camera Gear Podcast. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Lucas.
And we're here today to talk about the gear, software, and techniques we use to shoot photos and video.
Okay, Daniel. We had that, our last episode, we had this really great, like, 4K 60 extravaganza.
Yep.
Spectacular.
Yeah, we really, really went on about mm-hmm. that.
We got some feedback.
We did.
There was, like, rioting in the streets.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly how I would characterize it.
Mm-hmm. Just so much. Like, you dismiss one Sony camera.
Those Sony bros going to get you.
Okay, so I refuse to apologize ever, but maybe was unfavorable to the A1.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I listened back, I did think you were a little unfavorable toward it.
Wow, I feel like you're throwing me under the bus right now, Daniel.
No. Well, it wasn't me. That's all I'm saying.
And so, yeah, I mean, maybe worth looping back on that for like 2 seconds. I'm still not changing my recommendations, but the A1 exists and it shoots 4K 60 uncropped.
Is that all you had to say?
I don't know. Like, it's the I dismissed it out of hand because, one, it's still really expensive. Like, even if you're trying to find it used, I mean, you're still paying $5,000-something. I think you can buy it newish for like $6,000. Mm-hmm. It's not that much cheaper than an A9 III.
Yeah, that is true.
Yes, it's still an incredible camera, and like, but it shoots binned 4K. It's not oversampled, it's binned. And like the binned 4K is decent. Like, it's good. I would still prefer like an oversampled 4K compared to it. I think like I've seen a few different videos of like, you know, it's about as good as like an A7S III.
Yeah, that was the comparison I saw too.
Which, good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good, right? It's like good quality. I think that you're probably going to have a better time if you shoot 8K and then, you know, put it in a 4K timeline.
I think
it doesn't shoot 8K 60.
No, I think it tops out at 30.
And then like I think that you can only do so much within like how much heat that thing can take, just because of what it is. So like I think it's like if you have one of those things, it's a good camera. Like it's great for it. But I think if you're coming into this fresh, I think that there's maybe a lot of like extra stuff maybe you get out of something like a Z8, an A9 III. XH2S, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, the thing I wasn't sure about that I had to go back and look was rolling shutter, but it seems like the rolling shutter really isn't any worse on that camera than any other Sony camera.
Yeah, yeah, so it's good. I mean, it's a stack sensor, right?
Yeah, so that all seems fine. I mean, I think the feedback we got was basically saying, you know, what should I be watching for on an A1 in 4K 60? And like, what problems might you see? And I mean, it really seemed to me like when I look back at it, there really aren't any problems with it.
Yeah, there's no problems with it. I just think if you're coming into the market, you know, with a blank slate and you're looking for something that maybe can do more things, like has more, like if you're shooting, like if 4K 60 uncropped is really important to you, I mean, the codecs are still really important. Mm-hmm. Like, what are those data rates and that sort of thing? How far can you push it? And like, yes, you're getting 422 10-bit for that 4K 60, but like it's going to cap out at, what is it, like 200 megabits per second? I think it's all I, so like it's a really interesting codec, but it's, I mean, like I've tried to push some of those Sony files around, and yeah, the Sony 10-bit stuff, it holds up okay. The 8-bit stuff is hot garbage for Sony, and I know that like if you just have a little more information, like if you have a better codec, you're gonna be able to do a lot more with that footage.
Sure.
And so I think that that's kind of like where I fall off with some of the Sony stuff is like, yeah, like it holds its own, but you know, when given the choice, maybe maybe I pick something else for myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I was buying new and if my criteria was I want something for 4K 60, it would not be my choice of camera, but I think it's a fine camera for that purpose.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's great, right? And like, for me, the reason it's not the choice is really just like, if I'm going to have the option of bin versus not, I'm going to pick not.
Sure.
And if I'm spending that much on a camera, like, I'm probably not going to pick that camera.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. I think that makes sense.
Okay, cool.
Well, not that much else happened this week, right?
Yeah, so, that was it.
Yeah.
There was maybe a few, what do you call them, acquisitions?
Yeah, yeah. Just some little stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I think we probably it's worth mentioning, right?
I guess we should at least mention, yeah.
So the lens rental company,
mm-hmm.
Lens Rentals,
yeah, yes,
bought Borrow Lenses.
Yeah, I saw that. And I saw a headline about something. I guess Borrow Lenses has actual store locations.
Yeah, I think I think Lens Rentals is a bigger business,
mm-hmm.
and Borrow Lenses has kind of like shifted around a lot, but they have a lot of like inventory products, locations. They have more assets.
Yeah.
And so I think it was like an asset procurement for Lens Rental.
Interesting. Have you ever rented a lens?
I have not rented a lens. I've considered it a few times, but it's like a proportional thing. Whenever the times I was looking to rent a lens, I was like, man, you know, this lens is renting. It's like a quarter of the price or half the price.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I going to spend that much whenever I could just like buy the lens used?
Yeah. It's like you could buy it used. And then if you wanted to, you could sell it when you're done with it and probably, sure. You know, be fine.
Yeah. That's kind of where I landed on it for some of the stuff before. But like whenever you're talking about expensive lenses, like $2,000, $4,000, $10,000, $20,000, then it starts to make a lot more sense.
Yeah, if you're doing a cinema shoot or something like that.
Well, even like if I was going to spend, I'd rather spend like a couple $100 or $100 to rent a lens, like say it's a $2,500 Canon RF lens. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's 10% the cost. Of course, I'm going to rent it before I invest the money. But if it's something like a $600 or a $900 like Sigma or Fuji lens, am I really going to rent that?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. I think when we shot that TV show, I'm pretty sure some of the lenses from that came from Lens Rentals.
Okay.
So I think we have used rented lenses, but we have not personally done it ourselves.
Yeah,
I'm kind of in the same boat as you.
I thought most of those were from that local lens camera gear company, but I guess, yeah, some of them were from Lens Rentals.
Yeah, most of them were, but I think there was maybe one that wasn't. But yeah, I'm in the same boat. I mean, every time I've thought about it, I'll just buy this lens instead, and you know, it works out fine. So. Plus, you own all the Fuji lenses, so if I want to try one out, I just borrow from you.
Yeah, basically. I mean, yeah. I am a lens rental company.
Yeah, pretty much.
They're probably going to buy me next.
Yeah. You better watch out for that.
All right. Anything else worth noting?
I don't know. I mean, I guess we should talk about the other acquisition, right?
Okay. Nikon bought Red.
Yeah. So the other day, I couldn't sleep, and I'm browsing. It's like 4 a.m., and I'm browsing Twitter. And I see this Petapixel article and it says Nikon bought Red. And my first thought was, you know, is this like a weird fever dream? What's going on here? And
check the date.
I did check the date. I checked the date like six times. It's like, is it April 1st? And nope, not April 1st. Nikon just bought Red.
Yep. I'm going to reenact what I think happened.
Okay.
Okay. Nikon's like in camera rawing it up, right? And they think that whatever patents are stupid. Red comes in, they're like, we're going to sue you because you're using our patents. And Nikon, like, they come to the table and Nikon's like, you're suing us for how much? I mean, like, for that much, we could just buy you. And then they like kind of like look at each other and they're like, huh. And then the lawsuit just went away.
Yeah. It really explains why the lawsuit just went away.
Yep.
And maybe it explains why Nikon was magically able to start using that patent.
They're just at the table and they're like, oh, yeah, that would be funny. Ha 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 ha. What if you bought us? Ha 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 ha. But like for real, right?
That's pretty good. I like that. But yeah, it was super surprising news, right? And I don't know. I mean, I've been trying to think about what this means, but I didn't see this coming.
Just out of nowhere. Sometimes I don't think about or I forget about how small Red is in this ecosystem. Red is not a public company that I'm aware of. I think it was just owned by like the president and the founder. And if you look up like what's the revenue for Red, you know, a year, it's like, you know, maybe depending on the year, like $150 million, something like that. And, you know, I think it's fair to say like how much, like ignoring assets, you know, the revenue that a company can generate plus the cost of its assets is probably within reason how much it's worth.
Yeah.
So maybe Red's worth like, I don't know, maybe have a bunch of cameras on hand, call it $300,000 or something like that, $500,000 at most. Nikon is enormous. Nikon is like 18,000 employees and it's like, geez, $3.7 billion. Nikon is huge.
Yeah. I mean, they've been in the camera business a long time. And even though the, as we've said many times on this show, even though the YouTubers don't talk about them, they still do very good business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Red is, just for the records here, I think there are 220 people.
Okay.
Versus 18,000.
That is pretty small.
But like, you think about these cinema cameras, and I know it's all low volume stuff, but like really expensive. And I forget that like Red is kind of like still a scrappy upstart in a way. And even though they make like really cool cameras and they're very like customer focused and they do these like upgrade programs for the sensors, for their bodies, and they make just like super cutting edge stuff, they're still like just a little company.
Yeah.
And now they're part of Nikon.
Yeah. Crazy.
Crazy.
Do you know how much Nikon bought them for?
I couldn't find it listed anywhere.
Okay.
But even still, I was like, this just feels out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I'm really curious to know what's going to happen like with all the patent stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now Nikon owns the internal camera raw patent. And yeah, they've been doing like internal raw with their Z cameras. Are they going to start suing people?
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see.
That would be really two-faced, wouldn't it?
It would.
Nikon's over here like, how dare you? Like, this is dumb. You're inhibiting innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now they hold all the cards.
Yeah. I don't know. I you know, hopefully not. That's a feature I want to see on, you know, come to more cameras. But I guess we'll see.
Do you think so? Red RAW, like the Red RAW codec, is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, it's maybe half the size of like ProRes. Not even ProRes RAW, like just ProRes 4444 HQ. It's like half the size.
Yeah.
And it's raw. And so like you get all the benefits and all the quality and all the stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a really cool codec. Like, are we going to start seeing that technology in Nikon cameras? I mean, is my like, what are you, like Z9 Mark II or Z1? Is that going to, we have Red RAW?
I mean, that's kind of what I'm wondering, how they're going to merge these products, you know, like,
are they going to merge the product?
Well, that's what I want. I mean, it could be that nothing changes, but it also could be that, like you said, maybe Red RAW comes to Nikon cameras. Maybe we start seeing Z mount Red cameras.
I do want to talk about that because that would be weirdly interesting.
Yeah.
But it seems like, you know, the option one, like let it be its own thing. Mm-hmm. And just kind of leave Red over there, leave Nikon over here. And maybe the purchase was simply a matter of get Red out of our hair. Like, have them stop suing us so we can, like, do whatever camera stuff we want. Now we own them. We're going to make those sweet profits.
I mean,
it's going to be great.
It's possible, but that's such a boring answer. I hope that's not the answer.
Or the answer is, like, we're going to start seeing some really interesting Nikon stuff.
Because
Nikon has been, like, trying to be a video camera company.
Yeah.
Because it seems like those are the specs that excel mirrorless bodies right now, even though, you know, like, maybe we just want to take pictures. I mean, maybe not me and you, but some people, maybe they just want to take pictures. Well, like video specs are we're going to talk about the Leica SL3 later. And like, you know, oh, this thing can shoot 8K video. It's a Leica.
Yeah.
Who's shooting 8K video on a Leica?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
No one's buying it for that.
It's like these cameras have identities for like the specific things people expect them to be good at. And yeah, like if you go outside that, it doesn't really make sense. And Nikon seems like they're trying to kind of, they've always been in photo and they're trying to break into the video market.
Big deal when the Z6 and the Z7 came out, and they did this whole campaign with Ninja and how you can like shoot raw off of these cameras. And it was like a first or whatever. They're really pushing it and they want to be seen as like a video company, but there aren't really like cinema lenses for Z mount. And I don't know. It's kind of like a weird thing. I still think like the Z8 is a fantastic hybrid camera. It has fantastic video specs. But it seems like they're just really trying to reinvent themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe like the purchase of Red will help that.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me of how you know, you see like smartphone manufacturers partnering with some of these well-known optics companies, you know, to have a, you know, like a Hasselblad sensor in whatever phone, you know, that sort of thing. And it kind of makes me wonder if what we would see is a Nikon hybrid camera, but that they, you know, strongly advertise as like, this has red whatever in it, you know, not just red raw, but like this has like a red sensor in it or something like that. And I wonder if they might do that to try and, you know, get a hybrid body that video shooters are interested in.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. So the red, depending upon which red camera we're talking about, if you have a like a Komodo, it's going to be RF mount. Mm-hmm. But like the V-Raptor and the V-Raptor AK, and those have interchangeable mounts. So you can put PL or RF on those. I don't really know of any like Z-mount cinema lenses.
Yeah, that's
out
the
there.
Interesting part, right?
I have trouble imagining Nikon putting Z mount on a red camera. I also have trouble imagining Canon being totally cool with Nikon putting an RF mount on a Nikon red camera.
Yeah, it leads to a very strange situation there.
I would have been under the impression that if anybody bought red, it was going to be Canon.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who provides red sensors. We know that like they talk about how, you know, like design and that sort of thing. I've kind of thought, because like, of the RF mount, I was like, maybe they're getting their sensors from, like, Canon, like, under the door or something, and no one talks about it. I don't know.
Yeah. That would be really interesting with this whole purchase thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So yeah. I guess we'll see if there's, like, a weird sensor change for red cameras.
Yeah, that would be suspicious, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm.
Or maybe, like, if they do have, like, a sensor development team. I mean, Nikon, like, I don't know how much of their sensor development they do. I know that they buy their sensors from Sony. So maybe like they're trying to get back into the sensor game. That could be another avenue here.
Could be. Yep. About the RF mount thing, you know, I don't think we have it on our list to really cover today, but I did see an article that said that Canon is in talks with third-party manufacturers on opening up the RF mount. And the noteworthy thing in that article was them saying something like, they're more than 50% of the way there, or they're 50% of the way there, or something like that. And the commentary I saw was, who knows how long they've been working on this, and they're only halfway there. Like, this could be years away. But it does kind of make me wonder if maybe Canon's becoming a little bit more open to other people making RF lenses, and so maybe it's not as big of a problem as we would think.
I am still of the opinion that's never happening.
You could be right.
I don't think it's ever happening. I think that they're just postulating. They're trying to get the vloggers off their back.
I don't think
they're ever going to open up RF mount.
Well, it could be. I don't know. This was definitely interesting news though, and I mean, I hope something interesting happens from it. You know, I mean, I hope it's not just keeping the company running business as normal. You know, I'd like to see some kind of weird amalgamation of Nikon and Red, just because it'd be something interesting to see and talk about.
Yes, I am 100% here for something weird. Well, bring it on.
Yep. I want like a red camera in Z8 form factor. You know, something strange. I don't know.
Totally nuts. Or like a box style Z8.
There you go.
Who knows?
I mean, they could make something like a C70 and have it be a red camera. But
have all of the future Nikon cameras support the DMC like mount thing, like the electronic connection. You can start like attaching your V-Raptor monitor or like eyepiece to your Canon DSLR.
Yeah, there you go. I do want them
make
to
it weird.
I do want them to get the Z mount on there, just because we've already got the V-Raptor. We could have the Z-Raptor.
Heyo. If they call it that, that'd be horrible. It's obviously Velociraptor, and like, the red names have been crazy, like the Monster and the Helium and all this sort of thing. Z-Raptor.
Calling it now. It's happening.
Oh, boy, that'll be great.
Yep.
I'm not going to cringe one time. All right. Next thing I got on this list here, you put this sorbethane thing, and then you put an Amazon link into the notes.
Yep.
And I have no idea what this is.
Yep. Yeah, so we, one thing that we pretty regularly do is run broadcast stuff for a church. So running a bunch of live cameras, you know, for a live event, and we stream it on YouTube. And a problem that we've kind of always struggled with, and especially has gotten worse recently with some sound upgrades, is vibration on the cameras. And so we've got several fixed camera positions. We have, you know, some tripods, and then we have a motorized slider that kind of runs along the track. And, you know, when the sound is loud in the room, you get stuff vibrating like crazy, and you can see it on the cameras, like especially if you're zoomed in. And so we've tried to fix that in various ways over time, and we found some basically like egg crate foam and put that under the tripod legs, and it seemed like it helped. But, you know, it's always still been a problem. I mean, we have sandbags on the tripods. We tried all sorts of things, and nothing has really solved that problem. And so a couple of weeks ago, somebody came up to one of our production directors and was like, hey, I used to work at 3M, and you need to get this stuff. And mentioned this sorbethane stuff that I don't know who developed it. We'll put a link to the Wikipedia article, but I think, you know, like NASA uses this stuff for vibration reduction, and it's like it's this material that's made for that purpose. And you can buy it on Amazon, like in rolls or in little discs. And so we got some discs of it and put it under the tripod legs and put it under the slider. Stuff works really well.
Okay.
Dude was right. So I got to look at one of them and kind of see what the consistency of it was. And it's kind of hard to describe. It's not exactly like foam. I mean, it's almost like really hard jello.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking it probably would be based on the pictures.
Yeah, it's something like that. And it's, you know, the outside of it is kind of smooth and shiny. I mean, it almost feels waxy, like when you touch it. But, you know, it obviously has some flex to it, you know, and you can, you know, just place things on top of it, and it holds its form really well. But yeah, it's called sorbethane, and I just thought that was interesting. And, you know, if anybody's struggling with cameras vibrating, that's a pretty good way to solve it.
3M is a company that I don't really think about too much that makes an insane number of things.
Yeah, they do.
Like, Daniel, you have no idea. There's so much 3M stuff. They're in everything. Like, so much construction industry, like NASA and adhesives, and like 3M is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's just it's totally nuts.
Yeah, it's like one of the bedrock companies of America or something.
Like, kind of.
Yeah.
This is super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Neat stuff.
Okay, let's talk about cameras.
What have we been doing this whole time? Talking about business, I guess.
Hashtag business. There is a new Leica camera. I'm like, this has been on the list for a little while.
There are actually two new Leica cameras.
Leica's doing a lot.
Leica's making moves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to talk like for 30 seconds about the Leica SOFORT 2.
You would want to talk about that camera.
I wasn't even the one who originally put it on the list.
Okay, that's true.
You know how you super love those Fujifilm Instax cameras? And how you like really, really want one, and you've been eyeballing them for a while, and like you've almost bought one like 3 times.
I'm going to assume this is the universal you and not talking about me specifically, because I think we know that I'm not an Instax guy.
You're not an Instax guy?
I'm not an Instax guy.
I don't understand you, Daniel. Okay. This is two. I didn't even know that there was a one, honestly.
I mean, you got to catch up.
Leica is in this market, man. It feels like Fuji is chasing Leica with their rangefinder stuff and their like the X100 6 and all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then it feels like Leica is chasing Fuji, because like Leica, you know, film camera. I mean, if you're looking to buy a film camera, like a new-ish film camera, it's probably gonna be a Leica. Was it the M6 or something? I can't remember. I think it's the M6. I mean, they make an Instax camera. I don't know how else to call it. It shoots pictures. And then it prints the pictures.
I mean, that's pretty similar to an Instax camera.
Yep. And it's twice as expensive.
Of course it is. And the fact that it's only twice as expensive is itself a blessing.
Yeah. I mean, this thing's like, it's got like a 1/5-inch sensor. I don't know what's better about this than the version 1. I probably should have looked that up. But I was just so pumped that this exists. And you can buy it in red. And it's like 320 grams. And it costs like $400. And it says Leica on it.
Yep.
And you can just like shoot photos and then print them. This is so fun.
Even though it's twice as expensive as the Instax, maybe more. How much is an Instax?
It's like $125, something like that.
Okay, so it's really closer to like 3 times as expensive.
Maybe like 200. Depends on which one you get.
In any case, this is more expensive than that. But the absolute price of it is not that high. I mean, $400 is not that much in the scheme of cameras. And I could see somebody buying this instead of an Instax just to, I mean, like a name has a lot of cachet to it.
Yeah, you would do it to flex on people.
Yeah, and it comes in red, big plus. And I mean, I don't know. It just seems like it's, I mean, this is your best chance to own a Leica camera, Lucas.
I mean, maybe I'm just going to buy like a used Leica film camera.
Maybe you will. Maybe you already have.
That'd be so cool. And those Leica film cameras, you take the, they're different. Like you take the bottom off and then you put the film in and then you have to like stretch the film, kind of like unroll it. Like the, and like the back doesn't open, the bottom opens.
Oh, weird.
And it's crazy. It's just something else. You can't really see the Leica logo on the red version. Like if you get the black version, you can see the red Leica logo. And the white version, you can see the red logo.
Sure.
But if you get red on red, it's like buying a red GTI. You can't see the red stripe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a problem. You need people to know what brand that camera is.
Mm-hmm. It's it has like a, what size? The lens on this thing is like 3.5 millimeters or like 2.4 millimeters or something like that. It's like a 28 millimeter equivalent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's a very small sensor.
1/5 inches.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a small sensor.
It's itty bitty. It's also 4x3.
Huh.
I thought that was interesting.
I didn't realize that.
That's cool. You're shooting like basically 2K images or like 1080p. It's like 1080 by 424 something or whatever.
And maybe we didn't say it, but that 1/5 sensor is the same size as the sensor on the Instax, right?
Right. And they're like, it's like 4 or 5 megapixels or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It feels like it's exactly an Instax.
It really does.
But with like as color or whatever. I don't even know if they have cool color profiles, Daniel.
I don't either.
That's the one thing I don't get. If you buy an Instax, you can't like shoot in classic chrome. They have like different color profiles.
Yeah. You wouldn't be able to handle that.
What are we doing?
Yeah.
If I could buy an Instax camera and I could shoot in, I don't know, Rila or Provia or Bleach Bypass.
You'd be all about that.
Sure. That'd be super awesome. But no, it's like, they're like different things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Maybe the standard for film simulations from Fuji aren't stylized enough for the Instax crowd.
Could be. That honestly could be.
The prints for this, like the film is, I think it's maybe $15 for 10 sheets. It's like $1.50.
So how does that compare to Instax? Do you know?
Those are roughly like 20 for 20. So maybe $1.
Okay.
A photo.
So it is more expensive, but not wildly more expensive.
Yeah. Not crazy.
Yeah.
Huh. Still spending like $1 a pic.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it seems pretty cool to me.
I'm spending, you know, like 20 cents, 30 cents for a photo when I'm shooting on film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But how's that scanning going for you?
I don't want to talk about it.
You already did.
Actually, I do want to talk about it. Can we start over? Daniel, it's so hard. Ask me more about my film scanning.
No, we're done. We're not doing that. Sorry I asked.
Okay, let's talk about a real camera.
Another Leica camera, though.
Right. Okay, no, that one's real, too. Are you familiar with the Leica SL2?
I've heard that name before, but I, you know, for reasons that may be obvious, I don't really track their lineups that closely, so I kind of get confused about which camera's which. I know the Q3 or the Q2 is the, you know, the $6,000 X100 camera with a fixed lens, but I don't really, what is the SL series? Is that a digital camera with interchangeable lenses?
Yeah, exactly. It is your classic, you know, SLR, DSLR styled body mirrorless camera that takes L-mount lenses.
Okay, so it uses L-mount.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the L-mount Alliance, man.
Sure, sure. That fits. Okay.
Yeah. So, the SL2 was like 2019, $5,000. We're 2024. It's been like 5 years.
Yeah, lots happened.
Finally, SL3. It's a revolutionary camera, Daniel. I don't think you know anything about this.
I don't. Tell me about it.
It has a flippy screen.
That feels like an interesting choice for a photography focused.
I don't mean like flips out and then flippies. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. It's got a tilty screen.
Oh, okay. Well, that fits then. Okay.
This is very important because the SL2 had a fixed screen on the back.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's a huge upgrade then.
Yeah. And 60 megapixels.
That's respectable.
This is like the highest resolution L mount camera you can buy, except the M11.
Interesting.
Which has basically the same sensor in it.
Okay.
Well, the M11 is like a rangefinder style camera. A lot smaller. This thing's beefy.
Yeah, I mean, look at the picture. It's huge, and the logo, the text that says Leica is huge.
Oh yeah, that's like 36-point font.
Yeah.
It's enormous.
I mean, I think you're paying extra just to get a larger font.
Yeah, for sure. But this thing's got, it's got like all the specs, like a weird array of specs, and it's also like weirdly compromised.
Mm.
I've never quite understood some of Leica's line. I get the appeal of like a Q3. Did I get that right?
It's just funny because you said, I get the appeal of like a Q3. Yeah.
Sometimes I struggle with remembering their camera names. I am getting that right. Anyways.
The Q3 that's their X100 style.
Yeah, it's like, that fixed lens point shoot, yeah. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I totally get the appeal of that. Super awesome.
Sure.
And I also understand that like the Sumalux lens on that thing, it's like a $5,000 lens. And literally the lenses that Leica makes are so good. They make such good lenses. This doesn't come with a lens. It's just the camera. And maybe you put a Panasonic lens on it that cost $800 on your $7,000 Leica.
So
interchangeable lens.
You're telling
camera.
Me this is $7,000 and it doesn't come with a lens?
Right. That's just the body.
That is absurdly expensive.
It's so expensive. You know, like what are you gonna get? What are you getting for this, right? It has to be the best camera ever. I mean, German engineering. Mm-hmm. It's made out of magnesium. I think that's true. I'm just making that up. Anyways, 60 megapixels. It's got like ISO 50 to ISO 100. So like a fairly standard range. ISO 50 is pretty low for full frame.
50 to 100,000.
Thank you. 50 to 100,000.
That's a big difference, Lucas.
But it's not Sony level high ISO.
Sure.
50 is fine. It's respectable. I mean, most, what are we talking, like 80, 64, something like that for most full-frame cameras?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Anyway.
So it is it's in a reasonable range. I mean, I don't know. The specs seem fine.
It has this fancy Leica feature where you can just shoot in multiple resolutions. You can shoot this thing at 36 megapixels or even 18 megapixels.
Is that a crop mode on the sensor or
That's full width?
Interesting.
60 or 36. I guess it's binning or selecting certain pixels. I'm not exactly sure how they do that.
Weird.
But it is a feature.
Okay.
It's, I mean, like that's the gist, right? Has 5 stops of IBIS, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then it starts getting weird. Like it has CF Express Type B. Cool. It's got UHS 2 SD card slots. Cool.
Feels like table stakes.
Yeah, it's basically like an 8K sensor. It can shoot 8K video. It can shoot 4K 60 uncropped. It has like a 5.76 million dot EVF, which is fine. It's not 9 million dots that you'd find in a Sony, but you know, 5.7 is good, right? It's just kind of good all the way down. And then it has like a dedicated headphone jack and mic jack and USB-C. But it has a timecode interface?
What?
It has a dedicated timecode interface, which I don't understand. And it has all of these video features. They brought in like the phase detect hybrid autofocus from Panasonic, and it's not very good. It's okay, but it drifts a lot in video. And the video specs are just all over the place. Like I said, you can shoot in 8K in H.265. But if you want to shoot an H.265 in another resolution, you're out of luck. Everything else is H.264. You can only shoot in H.265 in 8K. And it has ProRes internal, but only in 1080p. So you can shoot in ProRes, but only in 1080p.
That's a very strange decision.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's shooting ProRes wants high-quality video. It's like, don't even provide the feature if you're not going to be able to provide it at 4K.
I don't know.
It feels like this camera doesn't know what it wants to be. I mean, the who's buying this to shoot video?
I don't know.
And the photo stuff sounds fine. I guess the 60 megapixels, the coolest part. Obviously, the Leica colors are the big draw on the photo side. But it is strange that Leica puts all these video features in because, yeah, I just can't picture who's buying it for that purpose.
I don't know. It shoots the 4K 60. But it line skips it, and like it is all 422 10 bit. I don't know. You can get oversampled 4K. So like maybe, like I don't know. Like it does the things. It's kind of cool, but it does feel weird for a lot of these different features.
Well, one thing that's strange about it is specifically talking about the video side. if you're buying this camera and these video features are appealing to you, I would almost say that if you're in the budget range where you're buying this camera, just go out and buy a, like, in addition to this camera, just go out and buy a Lumix S5 II.
Sure.
And use that for your video needs. It's going to be way better. And
it would have the same mount.
Yeah. Well, that's why I said that camera. But I mean, it's, yeah, like who has Leica money and wants to use this as their video camera?
Yeah. I don't totally get it. And I've kind of like breezed through some of these features, but I kind of wanted to loop back and talk about some of the gotchas that come to mind. And one, like, first, obviously, super expensive, $7,000.
Yeah, it was pretty high.
It shoots 14-bit raw in photo, as you'd expect, has burst modes, that sort of thing. But if you're going to your burst modes, if you shoot up to like 4 frames per second, you're going to get 14-bit raw. You shoot 6 frames per second, it drops to 12-bit raw.
Interesting.
So like, you can't shoot the high, like, the good files in high frame rates.
Yeah.
And it only goes up to like 15 frames per second.
I mean, this kind of reminds me of some of those caveats on the Fuji GFX,
mm-hmm.
the Deuce.
Yeah. So,
which, by the way, I would pick that camera over this because it's $500 more in its medium format.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, super weird, right? You can't shoot 14-bit raw faster than 4 frames per second, but it comes with a CF Express card slot. It's like, what?
Yeah, like, what are you doing that for?
Yeah, what are you using the CF Express card for? Like, maybe you're using it for the 8K. You're not using it for the ProRes because that's only 1080p.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing I can think of is that you get fast file offloads, right?
Sure.
So, like, if you've shot a bunch of 60 megapixel pictures, you can download them to your computer more quickly.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that.
Maybe it's just that. It's cool they added the phase hybrid autofocus, but, like, it's not very good.
I wonder what that is. You think it's just because the sensor's so high resolution?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. It just seems to drift a lot. Like, it's not as tuned. It's almost as if they kind of took what Panasonic did and just didn't really fine tune it for their camera and their sensor. They just took the tech and the algorithms and just let it go. That's what it comes across to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the viewfinder in the back screen, like, they're good, but they're not $7,000 good. They're not. They don't compare to the other high-end cameras. They don't compare to a Z8 or like an A9 III or an A1. They just, it's as good as like an R6 kind of thing.
Well, and I know something I've said before that I noticed on my X-T30 was, you know, honestly, it's kind of important to have a good quality EVF and screen, because when you're taking pictures, that's sometimes what's giving you feedback about how it's going. And, you know, as much as we try to not look at every single picture you take, you are looking at either the EVF or the screen as you're framing up your shots.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then you're going to look back at your pictures, maybe to check and see if your exposure was good, or just to get an idea of how your pictures are coming out. Or maybe somebody wants to see a picture you took of them. And in all those situations, it's kind of disappointing if you feel like you got a really good shot, like, you know, lighting was good, everything was lined up. And then you look at it, you know, on the screen, and it just doesn't look very good because the screen's not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and that's really disappointing and kind of brings you down. And then later when you get it on the computer, it's like, oh, well, this actually came out really good and I just couldn't see it on the camera.
Sure.
And so, yeah, if I'm buying a $7,000 camera, I want to be able to get a nice experience using mm-hmm. those features.
And I'm sure that it's fine. It just doesn't excel as standing out as this is the best of the best,
yeah.
Which, like, has never been Leica's thing. It feels like you look at a Leica camera compared to a modern Sony or Nikon or Canon, and like, it used to be that the Leica was all manual and it was just about the experience of shooting, which, well, like, always makes these kind of cameras seem weird that, yeah, this is still kind of about the experience of shooting. You look at the interface of the camera and the screen on the back and the way that you can like long hold and set all of your shortcuts and have it all just right there. And it has very simple buttons, but every button is customizable. It's a very much a like shooter focused camera, but it lacks all the like accoutrement of like a high end camera.
Yeah.
So it's Leica. I don't know. it comes with like just a few more like gotchas, right? you can sync with Flash, but it's slower. It's 1/200. Like normally you see like 1/250.
Yeah.
It's even slower for this camera, likely because of the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
They put a brand new battery in this, but it's still only SEPA rated for 320 shots, which is not very good. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it still feels to me like the only people buying Leica cameras are ones who really believe in the brand and are buying based on the brand. Because just on paper, looking at these cameras, I mean, in this one in particular, since we're talking about it, I don't feel like it justifies its cost.
It has to be one of those things where when you hold it and when you use it, it just, you can tell the difference. It has to be, right? Where like, wow, the ergonomics of this are just that much better and it feels super premium and it says Leica on it. So everybody thinks I'm super cool and like, oh, the weight and the build quality and this sort of thing. I mean, honestly, like some Fuji cameras, a little plasticky.
Yeah. 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 Maybe that's
even,
what it is.
Even some Sony cameras, like maybe it's just like that much of a higher
sure.
quality body.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is.
It always feels to me that the one of the big appeals of a Leica is the optics. And if you're in like the Panasonic world, you could go out and buy a Sumilux lens and put it on your Panasonic sure. L-mount camera.
Yep. And probably get a lot of those benefits.
Yeah. And get a lot of the Leica benefits without having to own a Leica body.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I mean, the highest resolution Panasonic camera is still an S1R. And it's like 40 megapixels, but yeah. that camera came out in what, 2018, 2019, something like that. It's pretty old
yeah.
at this point. And so, I mean, this SL3 is kind of like the high-end L-mount camera.
Yeah. Until Panasonic releases new stuff.
Yeah, until Panasonic catches up and releases their next-gen high-res still camera.
Yeah.
So I do think it's like interesting for that reason as far as, you know, here's the top end for L mount right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and I think in the past, sometimes we felt that, you know, Panasonic and Leica have some kind of a relationship, partnership. I mean, they're in the L mount alliance together. And I think we've wondered if Panasonic might, you know, prioritize certain updates over others to give Leica a spot and let them have, you know, a differentiated camera. And I mean, personally, I'm hoping that they're going to update the S1H before they update the S1R, because maybe they want to let Leica dominate in this space for a while they do that. But it does also make me think maybe what we're seeing here with things like that 60 megapixel sensor, maybe that's giving us a preview of what we might see in a much more affordable Panasonic L mount camera in the future.
Maybe it does feel like they kind of share a little bit of that market. As far as, you know, who's doing what and who's owning what. It also does seem a little bit that, you know, Leica and Panasonic are, they're just very different companies with very different audiences.
Definitely.
But at the same time, they're also sharing a lot of technology and innovation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true for sure.
Leica's just the high-end Panasonic.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't totally get Leica.
What do you mean?
I don't know. Their cameras are so premium and so fancy and so expensive. And I feel like I understood Leica when they were a film camera company and the advantage of having the lenses and the experience of shooting with a Leica film camera felt like a premium experience, from the way that it loaded the film to how it operated and the controls and just the experience of shooting with a Leica film camera.
Film cameras are very tactile and it's all about that control and experience. And that's a little bit less the case with digital.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, sure. It's just, it was that much premium over everything else that was out there. But with digital, I guess those things still have a lot of value as far as the experience of using it and the materials and all of this sort of thing. But for me, I have so much a hard time looking past the specifications and the capabilities and looking at something such as the SL3, where a Sony is going to be like way better in every department, from like the autofocus to the resolution to the number of shots on the battery to like the custom features to the video formats and everything and everything, and like Fuji and Nikon and Canon. And it just, it feels so hard to say, well, actually, I'm going to spend an extra $4,000 on something that has less features.
Yeah, I agree. I've never used one.
And maybe that's the problem.
Maybe. And I know they have their fans, especially like the Q2 and Q3 seem like those have been really popular with certain people. But yeah, I mean, for me, not having used one, it's hard to imagine ever feeling like I could justify it just because they're so expensive.
Yeah. It's just one of those out of reach things. Maybe that's their market, is they can just be up there out of reach, low volume in German, and just sell their prestigious cameras.
Maybe so. I don't know.
You don't think you'll ever own a Q2?
I don't think so.
Like maybe in like 7 years, you can buy a used Q2.
I feel like by then I'd be able to get a Fuji camera that was just better anyway. I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, who knows? You know, anything could happen. But right now, I don't think that fits my value proposition on cameras.
Yeah. I guess I'm kind of in the same boat. Maybe one day I'll retire and be in and feel like I need to get back to my roots, and I'll buy a Leica.
Yeah. Yeah, your roots.
I do think that I could see myself buying a Leica film camera.
Well, that's probably more reasonably priced, right? It's probably not too expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's still going to be between like $500 and $2,000.
Pretty high. But I guess, like you said, though, you can more easily see the benefits of them in terms of workflow or just user experience.
Yeah, for sure.
That makes sense.
I think the M6 is the current Leica film camera, and it is $5,700.
That's pretty high.
But that's a modern Leica film camera. Mm-hmm. You can find like used M6s in the $2,000 to $3,000 range. But if you go, but I would go back, you know, not something that was made this century. Obviously, I'd be looking for, you know, 70 to 80 miles. It'd still be not cheap.
Yeah.
But it'd be cool.
Yeah. I could see you doing that someday.
On my film journey.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have time for one more, Daniel?
I think so.
Okay. Sigma released an L-mount lens, because this is like L-mount day, except for the Nikon stuff.
Apparently.
And the Instax Leica camera is close L-mount
enough.
Also. So.
Close enough.
There's one. I guess we're only talking about one L-mount camera. Anyway, okay. According to Sigma, this is the world's first asterisk f1.4 diagonal fisheye interchangeable lens for 35mm full frame lens.
That was a lot of qualifiers, so I'm going to take their word for it that that's the first.
And that asterisk is as an interchangeable lens for full frame for consumer use. So all in all, this is the world's first for consumer use for full frame f1.4 diagonal fisheye interchangeable lens for 35mm conventional, I missed the line, 35mm format mirrorless digital camera.
Well, okay then. Good job, Sigma.
Wow.
Really breaking new ground.
Do you know what is significant about this being a diagonal fisheye, about it being a fisheye, or anything about this?
No, we need to break that down. Because, I mean, when I saw that, I thought, does that mean rectilinear instead of fisheye? But then why would it say fisheye? So I guess I don't understand this.
Okay. Rectilinear, if you shoot on a 35mm sensor, it is going to take up all the space on the 35mm sensor. Every spot is going to be a pixel with color to it or whatever you shot. And the lines are going to be as much as possible linear. Vertical lines will be vertical, horizontal lines will be horizontal from edge to edge of the frame.
They're at least intended to be linear.
Right. A fisheye, typically when you shoot it, is a circular fisheye. Most of them are circular fisheyes. And it cuts a circle out of that 35mm 3x2 sensor area.
Okay.
And it is not rectilinear at all. Everything is curvy around the circle because it has this really wide field of view, and it's a fisheye.
Mm-hmm.
A diagonal fisheye splits the difference. It will cover the full sensor area, but it is not rectilinear.
Yeah, so you get kind of that weird distorted fisheye effect.
Right, exactly. And it kind of depends upon like how you angle and how you shoot it. that those horizontal lines may curve up or may curve down, and the image is going to like bow away from you. And it's going to have that fisheye look, but it will take up the whole image.
Interesting. Okay.
What's significant about a diagonal fisheye is just the pure field of view.
Yeah.
A 15 millimeter rectilinear lens is going to be like 135 millimeters or something like that, field of view. Maybe not even that wide. I mean, it's like 70.
Sorry, do you mean degrees?
Yeah, degrees, field of view.
Well, you said 135 millimeters, and I'm trying
to... Oh, I meant degrees. Sorry, degrees. Did I get that right? I'm like looking at my notes real quick just to like double check that math. Anyways, doesn't matter. Like somewhere 74, 135, somewhere around there. This one is 180 degree field of view.
That's huge.
It's nuts. It's so wide. It's so wide, Daniel.
Yeah. I mean, that's like it can see something directly to the left and directly to the right of you at the same time.
Yeah.
That's very wide.
I know. I look at it and I go, how does the lens hood not get in the way?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. It's significant in that it is it's 1.4. And it's this crazy fisheye.
Yeah.
There are no lenses like this for mirrorless cameras.
Well, from what I've heard, this is the first one for consumer use.
You could buy diagonal fisheyes for like F mount, EF mount, but Canon, Nikon, Sony, they don't make this lens. Like nobody makes it. And so this is coming out for L and for E mount. And it's just kind of unique.
Yeah.
And it seems very much geared towards astrophotographers. Things that are significant and really cool about it is it has very good correction for, see if I can get this set. I don't even have it written down in front of me. Sagittal coma flare. Do you remember when we talked about the Noct?
I do remember us talking about the Noct.
How you can get these like weird, like conical flaring. Wide aperture, low light stuff.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Especially with aspherical elements, it's kind of caused by that. This is really good at correcting those.
Okay.
And that's a problem when you shoot astro, especially in wide, is getting these conical flares. Okay. And so really good at correcting for those. It has a little extra lip on the end so that you can put a lens heater retainer on it.
Say what?
Didn't you know this was a thing?
I didn't either.
You can buy a little heater that goes on the end of your lens.
Oh, that's adorable.
Like a little warm blanket.
A little electric blanket on your lens.
To keep it from fogging.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
So like if you're shooting at night, when the lens could fog, you put your little heater on the end of it and keep your little lens warm.
Wow. I mean, I was trying to figure out what this would be useful for, but astrophotography makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Like a really expansive view of the sky. It's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. So good correction. It's got the lens heater. It has spots for the soft slide-in filters that go on the back of the lens.
Mm-hmm.
And the lens cap has a spot to put those filters.
Oh, that's
you take
cool.
the lens cap off on the inside. It's got a slot for two filters that go on the back of the lens.
Oh.
And you just like take them off the lens cap and put them in the back of the thing. Super cool.
Man, why doesn't every lens work like that?
I know.
That's great.
It just has like all the features.
Yeah.
And it has, aperture and I don't know, autofocus switch and a custom button, that sort of thing.
Sure,
who cares?
Sure.
But it's like, this is like super, super neat and super, super unique.
Yeah.
Very much kind of a one of a kind right now.
I mean, this is the advantage of things like the L-mount Alliance and having multiple cameras use the same mount is that, now that they've built up their basic selection of lenses, you can get some of these weird things that don't really exist anywhere else. And I mean, I can't really think of a reason why I need this lens, but I'd be more inclined to buy an L-mount camera knowing that there's a wide range of lenses, including weird stuff like this, available for it.
Definitely. This thing is huge, by the way. And also, it's like decent. It has like really good, loco correction, not correction, but it doesn't like wide, really wide primes like this. Usually, you can get a little bit of like color fringing and like foreground, background, that sort of thing. This one's like super good at it.
Cool.
And it's like really, really sharp whenever you're focusing towards infinity. If you get like within, 5 feet or so, things can maybe get a little mushy. You have to stop down. Like, it's a really, really good lens. And it weighs like 3 pounds, which is still not as much as a Noct or a Pleno. But 3 pounds.
Pretty hefty.
It's almost exactly the same as far as casing and size as the Sigma 14 millimeter 1.4.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. But that one, interestingly enough, the 14 millimeter 1.4, which is a rectilinear lens, is 114.2 degrees of view.
Okay, so that's kind of a comparison then. Is that the rectilinear one's 114?
Yeah, that was the number I was looking for in my notes, and I just found it.
And that's a wider, that's 1 millimeter wider, right, which is pretty significant at that small size.
Mm-hmm.
So that one's 114, and this one is 180.
Yeah.
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 That's substantial.
It's so wide. And it just, I like it when lens manufacturers make stuff like this.
Yeah.
Where Sigma can go out there and say, we are a premier optics company, and we have a market for astrophotography, and these astrophotographies need lenses with rear mount filters and fisheye that are super sharp and have conal correction, and I can slap a heater on the end of it, and it is just really, really specifically made for astrophotography. There's going to be 15 people to buy this thing.
Mm-hmm. Just seeing that it has a heater mount on it tells you that they did research and understand their market.
Yeah, definitely. I love really unique things like this, and it's cool that it exists, and I guess it's also cool that it costs $2,000.
Price seems pretty reasonable for something that's very specific and that, like you said, they're probably not going to sell very many of.
Yeah, I have no complaints on that price. I think that is exactly how much this thing should cost.
Mm-hmm. Pretty cool.
Pretty cool. Really unique.
Good job, Sigma.
I don't think it's a legendary lens.
Well, I mean, it's probably too soon for that, for one thing.
But this could be a contender one day.
Yeah.
You know, depending upon how it ages and who uses it and you know, how it performs in the market.
40 years from now, if we're still doing this podcast, we'll loop back to this and decide if it was a legendary lens.
Man, we'll have to like replay clips from this episode in 40 years.
Everybody will be listening in their Apple Vision Pros or whatever, and we'll be talking about this old audio medium where we discussed lenses.
Yep. Those will be the days.
That's it for the show today. Thanks for joining us, and if you liked it, tell a friend so they can check it out too. You can find out more about the show at www.cameragearpodcast.com, and you can find us on Twitter @CameraGearPod. We'll be back with more next week.